Welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza, working on this pre-recorded program via remote. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Thursday, September 2nd, 2021. South Sudan government justifies cracking down on activists.
We have not prevented it, but we took precautions so that if they are surmised, then they surmised with discipline. They should not be destructive. They should not do anything. That is one. Number two, any demonstration calling for the system to go is not a peaceful demonstration.
And a South Sudanese bishop rejects a court order.
What came out from the court was not what we wanted. The court has referred back to the church, saying it is the church to go and resolve our case. We have rejected that.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The South Sudan government has defended its action after a planned nationwide protest by activists failed to take off on Monday. The protests were organized by a group calling itself the People's Coalition for Civic Action. South Sudan government spokesperson says any protest calling for the current government to step down will be counterproductive. For VOA News, Manyang David Mayar reports from Juba.
Following the crackdown on Monday, this week's planned protest, members of the People's Coalition for Civil Action said the government had proven it is an autocratic government by deploying hundreds of police and military forces on the streets of the South Sudanese capital, Juba. The coalition said the heavy deployment scared off people who might have participated in the protest. Speaking to South Sudan in Focus today, South Sudan Information Minister Michael McQuay denies the government prevented the mass protest, but says it is better to take preventive action when it comes to demonstrations that were calling for the government officials to resign.
We have not prevented it, but we took precautions so that if they are surmised, then they surmised with discipline. They should not be destructive. They should not do anything. That is one. Number two, any demonstration calling for the system to go is not a peaceful demonstration. If you go to the street today and you demand that I must go, if you say I must go and if I don't go, what will you do? You will go into violence. And if you go into violence, we will not tolerate that. So the best thing would have been prevention is better than cure. So we prevented it in order to have a peaceful South Sudan.
Several days before the planned protest, a spokesman for the South Sudan National Police Service warned the public not to turn out on the streets to demonstrate, saying anyone who did would be arrested. Organizers of the failed protest say the country has had enough of corruption and war, and it is time for the current government to step aside. McQuay says the Kiir administration will stay in power until elections are held.
Anybody who wants power should wait until that time when elections are run, and then he contests. If he passes, then he takes over the seat, and this is the meaning of peaceful transfer of power.
Activists say the government is intentionally delaying the implementation of the peace deal in order to stay in power. The 2018 revitalized peace agreement initially stipulated that South Sudan would conduct its first ever elections after the end of a three-year transitional period. Members of the People's Coalition for Civil Action say the time has passed with very few of the agreement's provisions implemented. McQuay insists the peace agreement's implementation is right on track and is calling on South Sudanese not to be co-opted by foreign forces.
These imported ideals which are inculcated into our people are the cause of the problem. Because even those who talk of South Sudan, of the government not implementing the agreement, are not genuine. And if you call them today and ask them, where has the government went wrong? They will not answer you. These are people who are just being moved by outsiders and being told to do so. If you have taken any money, please, and have your country at heart.
Abraham Awolich, a member of the People's Coalition for Civil Action, denies that claim.
Is Michael McQuay telling us that the people of South Sudan have no conscience? They have to be paid in order for them to speak out for what is wrong and what is right. Just because he's paid to be a spokesperson for the government doesn't mean that everybody else who speaks is paid. And so the People's Coalition for Civil Action is not a foreign agenda. It is born out of many years of frustration among the people of South Sudan for what is clearly a failed leadership in the country.
Aulich says South Sudan's peace partners recently reconstituted the Transitional National Assembly nearly 2 years after the executive arm of the unity government was formed. The parties have yet to agree on a joint military command and a date for graduating the unified forces. For VOA News, I'm Anyang David Mayar in Juba.
The former Archbishop of the Jonglei Internal Province of the Episcopal Church of South Sudan, Ruben Akurdit, has rejected court ruling dismissing a case he had filed against the head of the Anglican Church, challenging a dismissal from the Anglican Communion. A High Court judge in Juba referred the parties to a church tribunal to resolve their dispute. Akurdit, who returned to Bor Thursday despite a government order to stay in Juba, says he is still the Archbishop of the Jonglei Internal Province of the Episcopal Church of South Sudan. For VOA News, Dengai Deng reports from Bor.
Ignoring a Jonglei State Security Committee resolution ordering him to stay in Juba until the dispute over his dismissal is resolved, Bishop Ruben Akurdit returned to Bor Town Thursday, where he was greeted by hundreds of supporters at the Bor Airport. Many of Akurdit's supporters showed up at the airport dressed in uniforms of red and white, blowing trumpets and singing songs. Some were visibly emotional. A hymn they sang included the lyrics, "God has visited us with peace and our flag is up. God gives us power to defeat evil deeds." When the music ended, Akurdit moved to the front of the crowd and addressed the August 26 court ruling.
What came out from the court was not what we wanted. The court has referred back to the church, saying it is the church to go and resolve our case. We have rejected that. We said it was the church that defragged me, which just in body. The constitution presented now at the Episcopal Church of South Sudan was signed by Justin Body Arama, and he is not working with it now. He is working from his mind. We have rejected the court ruling and met on a field. We have come, and whoever is looking for us will get us here.
In December last year, the Jonglei State Security Committee, headed by Governor Dine Jog Chagur, ordered Bishop Akurdit, Reverend John Panchul, and Bishop Moses Anur to remain in Juba until their differences are resolved. Major General Joseph Mayana Kon, the Jonglei State Police Commissioner, says the order has not been lifted yet. He says Akurdit returned to Bor Town without the knowledge or consent of the state government.
I'm not informed. I've been just informed now when Akurdit has already arrived. So when we are alert, we are alert. For the reason why after consulting the deputy governor.
The standoff between Akurdit and ECS primate body began last year, when Badi fired Akurdit from his post as Archbishop of Jonglei Internal Province and the Bishop of Diocese Bor after he established 3 additional dioceses, including Makwach, Anyidi and Kolnyang within the Jonglei Internal Province without consulting other church officials. Akurdit filed a case in Juba's High Court challenging his dismissal. Last week, the court dismissed their case and referred it to a church tribunal for settlement. Akurdit's lawyer, Michael Mayan Makir, says his client will appeal the ruling. He says the Episcopal Church tribunal has been manipulated by Badi, and therefore he and his client do not believe it will deliver justice.
The primate is a chairperson or is a president of the church tribunal or the tribunal appellate. That means it's a last authority in the tribunal court, in the church. For that purpose, based on the Article 19 in the Constitution of South Sudan, amended 2015, read together with Section 20 in the Civil Procedure Act 2007. For that purpose, I see as a leading counsel in this case with my colleague, Dr. Gary Raimondo and Lake Panchol, we decide to appeal the verdict before the a court of appeal.
Canon John Agustino Lomori, the provincial secretary of the Episcopal Church in South Sudan, welcomed the court's ruling and said the Episcopal Church is willing to receive Akurdit back as a member if he ends his litigation in a secular court.
This court case has dragged us for some months, and on behalf of the administration, I'm so grateful to hear the verdict pronounced today by the lawyer. The Episcopal Church of South Sudan is one of the bigger churches in South Sudan that has all the structural organs. Discipline of church workers has its law in place. What had happened to the internal Archbishop of Jonglei internal province was a violation of the constitution and disobedience.
Peter Goch Anyang, a member of the Episcopal Church in Jonglei State, says he expected the court to resolve the matter once and for all because church leaders failed to amicably settle their differences. He says since the matter was referred back to the church, the two clerics need to sit down and find a peaceful way to work out their dispute.
The best way to reconcile or to resolve this issue is for the two parties to come together and try to agree amicably. Because if they don't agree amicably, this thing will take the church apart and it will also create disunities among the believers. I feel two parties to sit down and try to see the way forward so that the church can be unite again.
Episcopal Church followers in Jonglei State are divided over the matter, with Akurdit supporters calling themselves Independence ECS. Those allied to Moses Anur, who was appointed to replace Akurdit, have been running their own administration. For VOA News, I am Deng Gaideng in Bor.
The United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs is expressing concern over the plight of thousands of people affected by floods across South Sudan. The head of the UN OCHA in South Sudan says nearly 40,000 people affected by floods are in dire need of humanitarian assistance. For VOA News, Winnie Chirino reports from Juba.
21-year-old Ayen Ngor Ajok was displaced by flooding in the Chengdir suburb of Bor Town. Ajok says she and her two children have been camping at Marol in Bor Town for several months without humanitarian support.
We chose to stay here and not leave for other states to join an IDP camp, because we were hoping the government would render us some assistance. But now we have been struggling with our children by ourselves. I don't know, maybe nobody reported our condition to the government. We need food, shelter, and shelter materials.
40-year-old Athol Ko of Bor Town says his family has been miserable since the floods hit Bor because he and his children have had little access to humanitarian assistance. Ko says he has no place to farm in the town and he cannot travel to areas outside of Bor to produce food because of insecurity.
Life is difficult for us because there is nowhere to cultivate. The flood destroyed our homes and livelihood. If the government can hear our voices, then we urge them to assess our conditions. We need food, shelter materials, and utensils.
Abdul Haq Amiri, the head of UN OCHA in South Sudan, says people in Jonglei and Unity State are most affected by the floods.
Some 380,000 people have been affected by flooding in areas along the River Nile, Sud wetlands, and the rivers of Lol and Subat since May this year. Early seasonal rains have caused rivers to overflow their dikes and banks, flooding vast areas and settlements across the top of the country, with more heavy rains and flooding expected in coming months.
Amiri says most people affected by flooding have moved to higher ground within their county and plan to return home once the flood waters recede. He says assessments by aid agencies indicate about 100,000 people who were displaced by the 2020 floods from mainly Twitch East County are still sheltering in Bor and Mangala IDP camps as well as in Minkaman. Amiri says UN OCHA and its partners conducted a rapid needs assessment in 8 of the affected counties between May and August.
According to early assessments, priority needs include food assistance, emergency shelter and NFI, wash services and hygiene kits, health and nutrition supplies and services, protection services and dignity kits, and fishing kits for livelihood support.
Amiri says aid agencies are responding to the immediate needs of flood-affected people and efforts are underway to reach the country's remote areas.
Access is a major challenge, with majority of flood-affected areas inaccessible by road, and transportation of aid by air is very costly. Some of the flood-affected counties in Warrap State are highly insecure due to the ongoing subnational violence. Capacity in supplies on the ground are limited and need to be replenished to meet increasing needs.
Amiri says more funding is needed to scale up the response to reach affected communities. He says out of the $1.7 billion UN OCHA requested for the 2021 South Sudan Humanitarian Response Plan, only $940 million, or 56%, has been received as of the end of August. For VOA News, I am Winnie Sereno in Juba.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. Coming up, some South Sudanese living in Australia reject COVID-19 vaccines. Find out why after the break.
South Sudan in Focus is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1 202 630 8011. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan in Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1 202 630 8011.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. Some South Sudanese community leaders in Australia say they are concerned about vaccine hesitancy within the various South Sudanese communities in Australia. Dr. Garang Dud is a South Sudanese medical practitioner living in Australia. He says community leaders are working to educate South Sudanese living in Australia about the dangers of COVID-19. Dude says vaccine hesitancy within the South Sudanese community is huge, adding that if left without intervention, South Sudanese community will be left out in the current surge by the Australian government to ensure Australians are vaccinated.
That's true, John Tanza. There has indeed been vaccine hesitancy, particularly during this pandemic. And this is unique to this pandemic because in times before the pandemic, the data shows that our community had a greater uptake of vaccines because people appreciated the benefits they get from them, having experienced infectious diseases compared to, say, the communities which were predominantly born in Australia and have not witnessed a lot of infectious diseases. And so the pattern where people are getting more hesitant seem to have resulted from combination of factors, from people feeling a bit left out, not included enough, feeling targeted, and then a lot of disinformation over social media, which has been shared quite generously and competed with the official communication from the government. So we're trying to take more steps now as health practitioners within the community to allay these fears and give the correct information.
What are some of the fears? Give us examples of what community members are telling you their fears.
So the dominant fear is about blood clot, which is true. It has been demonstrated in some of the vaccines, such as AstraZeneca. However, the pattern of the clot has been shown to occur in millions of vaccinations. And this is not unique to the vaccine, because even with Panadol, there's a risk involved as well. Some people don't do well with it. And so it's just about any drug has a side effect. If you have a lot of people taking it, then whatever side effect exists with that is likely to demonstrate itself. And that will be the case with these vaccines. So the fear of blood clot is a dominant one, but there are other ones which have not been proven true, such as infertility. That's particularly very important for young people. They seem more scared because of fear about them being infertile after having the vaccine. But there's no scientific logic behind that can explain infertility from these vaccines.
How has the COVID-19 impacted the South Sudanese communities in Australia? I remember speaking to a friend in Sydney who told me that the pandemic has taken toll on some members of the community. Talk to us about the magnitude of this problem.
Yeah, so that's true. There has been unfortunate impact. We have lost a young man of South Sudanese background in Sydney, and there are a lot of people who are in ICU. So requiring oxygen to breathe as a result of having contracted COVID-19. And then on top of that, there are a number of people who have been infected and having had to be quarantined and therefore not going to work. So there's been socioeconomic impact as well on the community, where the breadwinner might be quarantined and not able to earn, and has often, among South Sudanese, there would be a lot of people dependent on one individual in the household. And part of the strategy we're working on is what happens next once we have reopened. How do we ramp up vaccination so that our community is better protected in spite of the disinformation? And so this is the bulk of the work we're facing now.
I understand you are working on recording messages in local South Sudanese languages so that it can be broadcasted on the social media or even on local radio stations. Why would you like to send your messages in local languages?
We are a community where adult population might not have gone to school for various reasons, most of them having been impacted by the war in the Sudan and now South Sudan. And so the official communication channels for the government have been online platforms as well as television. And those channels are not necessarily accessible to a lot of our community members. And so what we're doing is health practitioners within our community are organizing, such as to have trusted individuals dispensing this information. And this is crucial because trust is a big factor here. And if they get information from someone they trust, it's in the same sense that people get the wrong kind of information. So disinformation has been spread mostly through trusted channels. And so we are going to try to compete with that, with the correct information, to convince people in the languages that they actually understand. And this is the reasoning behind getting people who speak the various languages across South Sudan to be able to record messages with the correct information and then use the channels that we turn to communicate with each other through our trust network to be able to dispense disinformation. The hope is that once people get the correct kind of information, their fears would be allayed and they would be able to reconsider their position and understand that there are certain risks that might be involved, but the benefits far outweigh the risks. And this is more urgent now because today, Australia has managed to vaccinate 60% of the population, at least with the first dose. And the plan is that by the time 70 to 80% of the population in Australia has had their second dose, then Australia will reopen. So we will not stay locked down forever. But once we reopen and only about 30 to 20% of the population is left, potentially a lot of people from our community, because they have not signed up already, then this is the bulk of the population that would face the subsequent bouts of the pandemic. And we don't want that to be able to break up in our community. And that's why we're on front foot trying to take steps to make sure more people are vaccinated.
What will happen in future if the South Sudanese community remain hesitant?
So just like anybody who has not been vaccinated, they would be able to contract the subsequent bouts of COVID-19 because more people would be outdoor, more people would be interacting, understanding that like other infectious diseases where there are vaccines which attenuate or make the infection less severe, which is the reasoning behind these vaccines. Once someone is fully vaccinated, the chance of getting the COVID-19 would still be about the same. But once they get it, it would be less severe. They are less likely to need to be in hospital and less likely to be requiring oxygen and therefore going into ICU. And because of this, the risk of death is much lower compared to someone who is not vaccinated. And so if a lot of people in our community remain not vaccinated, they're more likely to catch the disease and they're more likely to get a severe form of it. And unfortunately, some might die from it. And that's what we're trying to prevent.
You are living in Australia where healthcare is very good And I'm sure you have seen a lot of people who are struggling with COVID-19. What would you tell people in South Sudan where healthcare is almost non-existing and there are people there who are still hesitant, who don't want to take the COVID-19 vaccines?
What we witness here is people who contract the severe form of the disease might not survive, and some might leave with long-term consequences. And so for those who live in places with poor health systems, say a place like South Sudan, where you might not get oxygen immediately, some of the medications are missing, it is even more important that people get vaccinated. And in a setting like South Sudan, you don't have many options, because the options people see in more advanced settings, such as having Pfizer as an option, it's because of other factors such as the storage capabilities. But once you go into a setting where the storage is lacking, then you might be limited to AstraZeneca. And that's fine. There would be relative risk compared to, say, Pfizer. But if you have it as an isolated medication or a vaccine in this case, then the risk factor would be weighed against the risk of contracting the disease. And knowing that once you contract it, you won't have the luxury of additional input of a capable health system, then it becomes utmost important that you actually get vaccinated. And so I would emphasize that more South Sudanese, particularly those who actually live in South Sudan, need to get vaccinated, and they need to get AstraZeneca as soon as it becomes available in the region.
That's Dr. Garang Majok Dut, a South Sudanese medical practitioner living in Australia. He spoke to me from Canberra. That's all we prepared for you this Thursday. We now leave you with MG Muzika from Western Bahr Al Ghazal with the song Janehe. Listening to MG Muzika with the song Janahe. I'm John Tanza. Thanks for allowing us into your homes, phones, and vehicles. Remember to always wash your hands with soap, practice social distancing, and wear a mask when you're in public places to protect you and others from getting COVID-19. Do not escape from COVID-19 quarantine centers, because there's no cure for coronavirus. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
We're dead, and I know, so I